From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. It is our monthly science roundtable, and our connection this hour was made in 2014 at Caltech. A team of researchers noticed something strange while studying the far reaches of our solar system. It seemed that something big seemed to be influencing the orbits of the scattered icy bodies out there beyond Pluto, and maybe they wondered some huge unseen planet was pushing those other objects around. But wait, an undiscovered planet in our own solar system? A real ninth planet that no one had seen before? It seemed, well, as an idea, out there. But this team of researchers was led by Mike Brown, an astronomer who was working to demote Pluto from its own planetary status just a few years before. He knows how sensitive the debate about planets can be. So before declaring that he had discovered evidence of a new planet, he ran some tests. If this thing was real, it would have to be twisting the orbits of those icy bodies in a very specific way. Otherwise, their idea of a newly discovered planet was probably all wrong. But at least that part doesn't seem to be wrong. Brown's team found evidence of five space rocks being pulled in exactly the fashion you'd expect if there were such a massive planet doing the influencing. Brown declared that his jaw had hit the floor, that he knew he was onto something, and last month his work was published in a scientific journal, and now the race is on to find this mystery planet, if it's there. Thus opens our monthly science roundtable, in which we'll talk about the implications of a new ninth planet, or a tenth planet, as one of the panelists will argue. For starters, my guests include this hour Brian Koberlein, RIT Senior Lecturer of Physics. Nice to see you back here, Brian. How are you?
Thank you. I'm just fine. Thank you.
Michael Richmond's here, RIT Professor of Physics, Director of the RIT Observatory, and Defender of the Honor of Pluto. Michael, nice to have you.
Hi-ho.
How many planets are in the solar system right now?
We'll have an interesting discussion, I'm sure.
Kevin Cook's here. He's a PhD student in the Astrophysical Sciences and Technology Program at RIT. Kevin, nice to see you.
Thank you for inviting me.
And I, you know, before the hour even begins, we're debating the status of planets and you know, talking about this so-called discovery. And we had a nice phone call from a listener who thought I was a fool for even, Oh, we fixed that? Okay. Well, anyway, the bottom line is this. Look, I mentioned earlier this that we, 5 years ago, there was talk about a ninth planet or a big undiscovered planet, and that there was a conspiracy, and that this was the source of the Mayan apocalypse in 2012 that it was going to crash into Earth, that we had not only either not discovered or we had kept it under wraps, and this was going to destroy the Earth. I think it was, I forget even the name. Brian, what was the name of this weird?
The common one is Nibiru.
Nibiru, but that's sort of a really ridiculous thing.
Yeah, way out there.
Okay, that's why there was never any evidence for Nibiru. Unfortunately, that might make people think that this new discussion is also baddie. It's not crazy, though, is it right? I mean, there's
no,
some validity here?
Yeah, there's real evidence.
Okay, so there may be another planet out there. And I want to start with Brian and just kind of go around the table here. The report comes out that they've got this evidence. That we can't see the planet yet, but they think it's there. I mean, what does this mean to you? This could be a huge story.
It has the potential to be a very huge story for a couple of reasons. One is it would be a new large planet in the solar system. It would be a outer planet, so well out beyond the planets that we know now. And it also has the potential to be what we call a super Earth, a planet whose mass is between kind of Earth's mass and something like Neptune.
Okay. Michael Richmond, for you, you know, whether this would be the ninth or the tenth planet, we'll get into that in a minute, but are you a skeptic so far that there is a planet that we can't see that's huge, that's way out there in our own solar system?
I like to be a skeptic about just about anything because
fun. Hold on, let me reel it back. Skeptic is a term of honor on this program. I hope we're all skeptics. Are you a cynic or are you a non-believer yet, I guess?
I think the evidence is intriguing. What interests me most about it is this would be the second time, if it turns out that there is a planet out there, this would be the second time that a scientist has predicted the presence of an unknown object based upon its gravitational perturbations of other things that we can see. Back in 1846, the planet Neptune was discovered in exactly this way by its influence on the known motions of Uranus and Saturn.
So there's precedent for this.
Yes, and it was a very big deal, showing that Newton's laws applied all throughout the solar system and the universe. This would be not quite so big a deal because we've had 100 years worth of experience since then, but it's still pretty impressive.
And if you're sitting there listening to this saying, well, if there's all this evidence that there is a planet there, but we can't see it, shouldn't we be able to see it? But look, if you ever watched Charlie Brown, you knew some teacher was talking to him, making those weird noises. We never saw the teacher, but we had evidence that the teacher was real. And eventually, we're gonna see if we can find this planet. So in a moment, we'll talk about how that's going to happen. But Kevin, before the hour began, was even educating the host on the fact that this debate about planets, statuses, etc., goes way, way back, well before 2009 or 10 when Pluto was up for debate. 1801, what was going on?
Yeah, so 1801, the dwarf planet Ceres was discovered in the asteroid belt. Ceres is actually quite big. It's about a third of the mass of the asteroid belt, all wrapped up in one body. So it's quite influential there, but it's still really small, much smaller than Pluto even.
So we've been debating what's a planet for a long, long time. Is Pluto a planet to you?
I don't consider it a classical, like, terrestrial planet. I consider it a dwarf planet. I like having separate labels that tell us different things about the different objects we have.
Okay, but if you're creating a classroom model, diorama for third graders, there'd be eight right now?
There'd be eight planets.
There would be eight. Michael Richman, if you were creating that same model, there would be...
Well, answer me this. If you were asking students about the continents of the Earth and you were teaching them geography, would you say that Europe is a continent?
Oh, that's good.
What I would do is tell students, for a long time, people have talked about Europe and Asia. They've separated people who live in Europe, the languages they speak, the cultures they have, from people who live in Asia. And to some extent, that makes sense because they are pretty far apart. If you want to separate Europe and Asia, even though they're not really separate, then you could say it makes some sense. In the same way, it makes some sense to talk about Pluto as a planet, even though you can't really make any good case that it should be considered a planet like Earth, Venus, or Jupiter. So I like holding on to old labels for traditional sake, even if there's not a good reason to do so.
Okay, so there might be nine for you. Brian, Pluto is a...
It is a body that orbits the sun.
Oh.
I think this is a great way to bring up the conversation about the diversity that we have in the solar system and also how we gain more knowledge. Our understanding of things change. So when Pluto was called a planet, we knew very little about it. We knew that it orbited the sun. We had no real idea about its size. Now that we've had a flyby, we actually know it's geologically active. We know its size and everything else. There are arguments to go both ways. Right now, it's not a classical planet. That may change.
But this discussion this hour is about, I think, the value of this exploration and discovery as we continue to be able to do new things. And it was no less than Buzz Aldrin at age 86 writing in Time magazine last month, weighing in on this idea of a heretofore unseen planet that's out there that we might be able to find, that might be real. And here's what Buzz Aldrin wrote about that. Quote, Planet Nine is a should-be-there world. That is, nobody has yet spotted the object directly. But thanks to mathematical modeling and computer simulations, this distant world could have a mass about 10 times that of Earth. If truly a resident of our neighborhood of planets, this supposed planet would make one full orbit around the sun that takes between 10,000 and 20,000 years. Given that a few years ago we demoted Pluto from its planet status, the claim of a Planet Nine adds up to one fact. The planetary census of our solar system is clearly unfinished business. That's what space exploration is all about, defining new boundaries. A potential new planet offers great satisfaction for those of us who look for things out there. Buzz Aldrin. What do you think, Brian?
I think that's a good summary of it. I mean, it's part of the thing in which we explore farther and we get more data. We learn more. And, just as 100 years ago, Uranus, Neptune, Pluto were at the cutting edge, now we've got other possibilities.
Let me ask then the director of the RIT Observatory, if this is a planet that is doing all the influencing, if this is out there, how come we haven't been able to see it yet? Is it just powerful instrumentation that's not powerful enough yet?
So the influence of this planet on objects we can see suggests that it's very, very far away from our sun. Earth is at a distance of one unit away from our sun, one astronomical unit. The most distant big planet, Neptune, is about 30 astronomical units away. At that distance, the sun's light is dim, and so seeing objects is hard because things tend to be illuminated faintly. The orbit of this new object that's postulated would put it somewhere around 1,000 astronomical units away from the sun, about 30 times farther away than Neptune, which means the sunlight reaching it would be about 30 squared, or 1,000 times weaker than the sunlight striking Neptune. That means if we're looking at sunlight reflected from this distant body, it's going to be very, very faint. Only the very largest telescopes we have on Earth would be able to detect this planet, and we'd have to look pretty hard with them in exactly the right place to find it.
Wow. I mean, this is like if all of the planets in the solar system that we know about are between downtown Rochester and Cornhill, and there's a new planet that they discovered that's in Canandaigua. I mean, it is way out there. So what's the timeline? I mean, the guy who made this quote-unquote discovery, or at least is making this claim, has come out and said he wants to be the guy who can find it now because the race is on to see if it actually is there. So actually, let's listen if we could. This is Mike Brown from Caltech, the astronomer who is making this claim based on his research there. Let's listen to some of his comments to NPR.
My jaw hit the floor. That just came out of the blue. So, you know, being able to make a prediction and having it come true in 5 minutes is about as fun as it gets in science. I want to see it. I want to know what it's like. I want to see that it's really there.
All right, so that's Mike Brown. There's a couple of points there. What is he talking about when he says to have a prediction come true in 5 minutes? What he's saying is they knew when they detected that there might be a planet way out there, a big one, based on what it was doing to other objects in other places, they would have to kind of run some other tests and, well, if it's a planet, then this is going to be happening. And if it's a planet, then this is going to be happening. And he essentially started finding those things were actually happening. So, Brian Koberlein, you want to explain a little bit more? I mean, even if we haven't seen it, it's the evidence that there's something there.
Yeah, it's the indirect evidence. Basically, what they're looking at is bodies that are on the outer edge of the solar system as far as we know. And so, you know, somewhere around 200, 250 astronomical units. And if they were the last of the large bodies, kind of Pluto-sized bodies out there, you would expect that their orbits might be kind of randomly oriented around the solar system. And the ones that we found tend to be clustered off in one direction. And that would imply that something is kind of torquing their orbits over geological time. And that's where you start looking at the statistics and the mechanics of it in terms of there is possibly this gravitational influence from a large planet.
What kind of planet would it be?
The new planet?
Yeah.
Would be of super Earth is what they would call it.
But I mean, I've heard a lot of people saying, well, it might be gas, gas-based. But do we have any reason to know what kind of planet it would be?
There's speculation, but the problem is that right now we have not observed directly any super Earth. We've seen evidence of super Earths around other stars, but we see that by the influence on their star. We don't have a direct image of it. So there are models about what these might be like, but they're kind of in between a rocky planet and a gas planet. They're kind of almost a new class or category of planets. We don't have any examples, so we don't really know.
Do you need if this were one of them? Michael Richman, you want to jump in there as well? Go ahead.
So one of the things that makes this intriguing is when people try to study how the planets formed long, long ago when the solar system was very young, the most successful models predict that massive things like Jupiter and Neptune and Saturn and even the Earth should have formed relatively close to the sun, sort of at the distances where we see them now. So Earth where it is now, Jupiter maybe 5 or 6 astronomical units away. But they predict that very little very few massive objects might have formed very far away from the sun. If this is a massive body very far away from the sun, either it was formed close to the sun near Jupiter and Saturn's orbit and somehow had to migrate from that initial position way out into the outer reaches, or if it formed far, far away where it might be now, if it really is there, how in the world did it form? The current models would not explain it very well. So that's a bit of a mystery.
Which is a lot of fun here. So let's listen to some more of the comments about this, because NASA has already weighed in. So let's listen to what Jim Green says. He's NASA's Director of Planetary Science. This is his comment about this potential new planet out there.
It's too early to say with certainty that there's a so-called Planet X out there. What we're really seeing is an early prediction based on modeling from limited observations.
All right, that's Jim Green of NASA. Now let's listen to astronomer Scott Shepard of the Carnegie Institution for Science and his thoughts on this.
So objects get very faint very fast. We really don't know the distance of this object, and if it's at the further ends of where we think it might be, then it would be too faint to see. We really need to find more of these objects, more of these smaller objects that can lead us to the bigger object. I think it's still a toss-up if it's really out there or not. I think we just need more data.
All right, and right on cue, an email from a listener, Mark, just wants to know, didn't we do this 5 years ago? Again, very different. This is not the same as that weird discussion about Planet Nibiru. Here's Neil deGrasse Tyson, in fact, a few years back, putting down the idea that there is a Planet X or Planet Nibiru that is not only the undiscovered planet, but it's going to crash into Earth and kill us all.
The planet today is a marvelous work of fiction. There is no such thing as Planet Nimburu or whatever they say. It's just fiction. And they cite sources that cite NASA sources. They don't cite NASA. Check the websites, you'll see. And it's all related to the doomsday predictions of the year 2012.
So, Mark, that was bunk. What we're talking about now is something that at least something is happening. We can at least say we know something strange is out there. It might not be a big planet. It may be a big planet. Brian, what else could it be?
You know, it could just be a statistical anomaly. It could be that they just happen to be aligned in this way by chance. The odds are not particularly high, but by scientific standards, it's not enough to rule them out.
Sure.
There could also be other more subtle type of interactions that are causing it that are not a planet. Of stellar close encounters, for example. And by close encounters, you mean, you know, on the order of maybe tens of thousands of astronomical units. That happens from time to time. You know, you can have those types of things. We just have to really get more data to really figure it out.
Michael Richman?
Yeah, as Brian said, this could just be a bit of either good luck or bad luck, depending on how you define it. The analysis that Brown and Batygin, he had a co-author on the paper that was released recently. They did an analysis of the 12 or 13 objects that are in the outermost reaches of our solar system. We don't know about many of them. We're missing most of them. They discarded all but six because the orbits of those other objects are perturbed by Neptune, so you can't really use them for these purposes. And there are statistical arguments on how likely or unlikely this alignment of orbits is really based on six objects. So imagine rolling a die six times. You're probably not going to get six ones. But if you did it 100 times, you might get six ones. If you did 1,000 times, you'd probably get six ones.
Multiple times.
Exactly. So it's a little, at the moment, we just don't have enough evidence to say one way or the other for sure.
Listeners, on this subject of possible randomness, and go listen to the Radiolab episode called Stochasticity. And for all of you who think that you couldn't get seven coin flips in a row the same, do it 100 times. You will do it. You might actually do it twice or three times. But listen to the Radiolab episode, Stochasticity. And that's a big reason why we can't just immediately assume that the alignment of what these icy bodies are doing is ipso facto evidence of a big body. It's a good start. But the optimist on the panel is Kevin Cook, a PhD student. You're an optimist that we've got a planet out there.
Yeah, I like saying that I'm a cautious optimist with this kind of stuff. Because you do like to see a nice, even distribution of these icy bodies out there. And for something to be this special, like all of these alignments at once, it generally points to the fact that you should have something there and fairly recent in order to keep that alignment going. And so that's helping the planet case.
All right, so maybe the analogy is when the socks in our household get done, you could toss them haphazardly, randomly towards your dresser if your dresser drawers are open, and some of them will fall into certain drawers and some of them will hit the floor and some of them will end up on the bed. And in this case, all of the socks are neatly bundled in one single drawer, nice and orderly. And if you did that a million times, maybe somehow that would actually happen, but it seems unlikely. Is that
exactly? It seems very unlikely that something like this could just, you know, spontaneously happen.
Randomly occur. It looked like somebody balled those socks up and put them in the drawer. And in this case, it would be a big, big planet. So if you want to call the program, if you've got any questions about this, it's a fun subject, but we're going to be talking about some of the implications in a minute here. You can do that. It's 844-295-TALK. Toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI, 263-9994. My guest, Kevin Cook, you just heard him, a PhD student in the Astrophysical Sciences and Technology program at RIT. Michael Richman, an RIT professor of physics and the director of the RIT Observatory. Brian Koberlein is the RIT senior lecturer of physics who joins us from time to time to help illuminate on these issues. And Kevin, for you, what's the implication? If this is real and we eventually get evidence of it, what does it matter? Why does it matter to us?
I believe that it matters because this planet, being around 10 Earth masses in size, represents this gap in the size of planets that we've previously observed in our solar system. We have the four terrestrial planets that, you know, go up to one Earth mass. We're just talking about, you know, in units of Earth masses. And then we have the gas giants, which start at around 15 and then go up from there. We have this gap in between 1 and 15, and perhaps this new planet is something that formed in the middle of that range and was somehow kicked outwards. So it would represent something that we haven't seen before, but seems natural to fit into this progression.
Mm-hmm. Michael Richman, what would it matter to you? What are the implications of a planet if we get evidence of it?
Well, if we were to find it out there, as I mentioned before, most models of its formation would predict that it would have formed much more closely, much more close to the sun. So it might teach us how objects can be ejected from the inner parts of the solar system into the very outer regions of the solar system and then stay there, because it's likely that if it does exist out there, it's been there for 4 or 4.5 billion years, and it's not so easy to get things to stay far away once you've ejected them.
Okay. And would that teach us that everything we thought we knew is wrong? Would that teach us that there are a lot of things that we need to, you know, based on that discovery, are there new questions that arise?
I think that most of what we know so far is probably pretty correct. Maybe those people who are looking into the details of planet formation and migration, as some professors at the University of Rochester are doing, would learn quite a bit about which of their models work and which maybe don't work so well.
Mm-hmm. Brian Koberlein, what are the implications for you if this is real?
One of the interesting things for me is that it would be a large planet so far away from the sun that it's basically driven by its own heat. And it's one of these things about understanding both outer bodies in the solar system and other possible bodies like rogue planets that are between stars, is that they're almost on their own. This would be kind of a transition. And, you know, Pluto's a good example that we found a lot of surprises, and that we would think, oh, it's a small body on the outer edge of the solar system. It's probably just a cold rock. And what we found is mountains and evidence of activity and it being far more complex than we thought. Well, this could be an example of something in which it's a new area that we have no understanding of.
All right, let me get to the phones, and Malcolm in Rochester with a first up for the hour here in our monthly science roundtable. Go ahead, Malcolm.
Two comments. First, I'm not certain that the peculiarity of the outer, Kuiper belt objects is sufficient. I haven't seen a discussion of what the biases are on the searches that have been made, so that the fact that when you just kick out all the Neptune-affected objects, you're producing a bunching by that action. And then historically, there have been papers written that deny that the discovery of Neptune followed from the mathematical discussion of the motion of, I think it was Uranus. The point is that, yes, it was successful, but people argue that they used the Bode's law to predict where the planet would be, and other details made them feel that the mathematics was not sufficient. Thank you.
Thank you, Malcolm. Thoughts, panel? Brian?
I think it raises up a good point. I mean, we talk about the example of Neptune being discovered because of the predictions of Newton's laws. But there are cases in which we made predictions and it didn't work out the way we thought. One of the things is there's the motion of Mercury, and its orbit actually precesses slightly. And one of the possible predictions was, well, maybe there's a planet closer than Mercury that people actually named Vulcan. And there was this large search in the 1800s for it, never found it. And that's because the perturbation of Mercury's orbit is actually caused by general relativity, not a pull of a planet. Bringing up Bode's law, Ceres obeyed this rule that was called Bode's law and was in the location that was predicted to be between Mars and Jupiter, just by happenstance. It has nothing to do with Bode's law, because that's just kind of a numerical trick. And Neptune, for example, doesn't follow it, neither does Pluto or the other bodies. There is reason to be cautious about mathematical predictions and looking at the statistics. And I think that's part of the reason why we're kind of cautious or cautiously optimistic. It's enough to be intriguing, but it's not proof. I don't think any of us would say that the planet absolutely does exist.
Okay. Michael Richman?
So the caller brought up a very good point about biases. We're talking about objects in the outer reaches of the solar system, and it turns out that there's been no single survey of the sky sensitive enough to detect these outer bodies. The six objects we're talking about, whose orbits are aligned in a certain way, they weren't discovered as part of a systematic survey of all the heavens. They were found piecemeal by different people using different telescopes and different techniques, and we've only put all the information together recently. So there are all kinds of systematic effects and biases that could creep into one's analysis if one hasn't made a systematic and uniform survey. And that's one of the problems with evaluating how significant these alignments are. There could be reasons why we only notice and detect planets or Kuiper belt objects in certain directions, and that could end up making it look as if their orbits are aligned.
Hmm. Kevin, what do you think?
Yeah, the bias point is definitely a very good point to make, especially considering one telescope, the WISE telescope, which surveyed the entire sky in the infrared, is not sensitive enough to pick up many, many of these objects. It can only pick up some of these, maybe if they were at their closest point to the sun and being heated up enough to emit in the infrared. And that means that you have to be lucky in order to see them. So we could be missing many objects that even out this distribution, and we just don't know.
Okay. And by the way, when did Vulcan get its name, Brian Koeberlein?
It was in the early 1800s.
Is this related to, is this the genesis for the name?
I'm not sure of the Star Trek history. There is some connection. I mean, Vulcan was a god of forges, and the planet Vulcan in Star Trek was supposed to be a warmer planet.
I'm going to out myself as not a Trekkie, so you know, I didn't have the background, but I heard the name. So
yeah,
couple questions from Jake. Jake writes: first of all, the shorter question is: if we found this planet, how long until a probe, positive discovery, could be a real unifying funding target? It's not like you find a new planet every day. Great PR for politicians. As amazing as it was to get to Pluto, too far away, to right now at least?
Oh, yes. To get to Pluto, it took 9 years and quite a lot of funding and the project getting canceled and reinvigorated and canceled and reinvigorated even before that 9-year trip. So to get to this tentative Planet Nine, we would have to even know precisely where it is to begin with, and we're really lacking in that information. So it's still quite a while until we figure that out, and then it would still take decades.
Okay, and just in terms of distance, an astronomical unit is the sun to the Earth.
Right.
And Neptune is 30 astronomical units away, mm-hmm. and this thing could be 100?
1,000.
700 to 1,000.
I'm sorry. 700 to 1,000.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So 30 times Neptune. So, yeah, it's a
30 times 7 years would be something like
couple centuries. Yeah.
Yeah.
This would be a long, long range. So, Jake, to your question on political, you'd have to be thinking about your grandchildren's grandchildren, grandchildren running for president and then taking the credit when the probe finally gets there. But by then, maybe the technology would be much better. Now, here is Jake's other question. He writes, I don't have the link handy, but I've already heard of one possible alternative explanation for these disturbances. The veracity of that claim is sketchy, but what do your guests place as odds on this actually panning out into a visible discovery? My biggest concern is that there is a much simpler answer to this, and we never find George, which is what the paper's authors want to call it. There could be some very serious existential damage to science in the eyes of the public if this claim is busted. Brian?
I'm not sure what George would refer to.
I guess the name of the planet.
Is the caller saying that there's another explanation for the alignments?
I think he's saying maybe there is, but his bigger concern seems to be if this claim gets busted, does science have egg on its face?
No, I think no one is claiming authoritatively that this planet actually exists. We may be hopeful for it. But making claims, looking at the evidence, and then testing that is part of what science is. So if we find out that this doesn't work, well, we move on. you know? And we may just find this to be a statistical oddness that doesn't seem to have a cause, and we can live with that.
Okay. Michael Richman?
I don't think it would be egg on a scientist's face if the authors of this paper had said, there is a planet, it is at precisely this location, we want to give it this name, and by the way, we think it's green, then not finding it would probably be a very embarrassing thing. But they've said, here's some evidence, one way to explain it is to postulate the existence of a planet far, far away, let's try looking for it. That seems to me like an eminently sensible thing to say.
Agree, Kevin Cook?
I completely agree. It's the scientific method of you see pieces of evidence, it leads you to a hypothesis, you go and test that. And even if it does not work out, you've still learned something. For example, in this case, we'll be learning about maybe there's another reason why things could be aligned in the outer solar system. And not finding Planet 9 could lead us towards that other explanation.
Okay, well, maybe Jake is spurred into thinking there could be egg on science's face based on NPR's reporting. Let me quote the other quote from Michael Brown. Mike Brown, the astronomer whose research is behind this ostensible new planet, he told NPR, quote, I'm willing to take bets with anyone who's not a believer. And then he said he thinks existing telescopes have a shot at spotting this mystery planet in just a few years, since this new study points to a band of sky where astronomers should look. Michael?
So I think he's doing this at a good time. It's kind of a good time to say this. One of the most powerful telescopes in the world, the Subaru telescope on Mauna Kea, which is a Japanese built and run telescope, has a mirror about 26 feet in diameter. So it's a really, really big telescope. It gathers a whole lot of light. It can see very faint things. In the last 2 years, a new camera has been put on it that can detect much fainter objects than before over a much larger area. The Hubble Space Telescope, if you pointed it at the moon, would see one tiny little crater on the moon. This camera on this telescope could see 5 or 6 moons lined up side by side. So there actually is now an instrument which has a big enough mirror to collect enough light to see a very faint object far from the sun and can cover a large area in one shot. I sort of worked through the numbers in a very hand-wavy way and figured that if someone devoted that telescope to a systematic survey of this region of the sky that Mike Brown and his colleague Konstantin Batygin had pointed out is most likely to be the home of this planet, it would only take 3 to 5 years of work. Now, of course, lots of people want to use this telescope, and not all of them want to look for this planet. So asking for hundreds of nights on this telescope over several years would be a big ask, but it's not impossible. It actually is possible for us to sort of find it if it's there, if we have the will to spend the time to look for it.
All right, Bill in Spencerport with a question on Pluto. Go ahead, Bill.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I just wanted to ask what changed that disallowed Pluto from being a planet? What's the definition of a planet, and why does Pluto not meet that any longer?
Michael says, anybody but me. Kevin, I'm going to start with you.
Sure. Okay, I can start with this part. So one of the criteria for being a planet is to clear the majority of material out of the planet's orbit. So as the planet moves around the sun, there really shouldn't be very much in the way. And Pluto crosses Neptune's orbit. So it isn't dominating the gravity around its entire orbit. In fact, Neptune actually takes part of that responsibility for small sections.
Okay.
And that's one of the reasons why we don't consider Pluto to be a full-sized terrestrial planet.
Okay. Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call. That explanation work for the senior lecturer on the panel, Brian?
Yeah, I think it's a good explanation. I think if you wanted a different analogy, it's that within each planetary orbit, it has to be the biggest planet on its block. And Pluto isn't, because it overlaps Neptune. So Neptune wins because it's much bigger than Pluto.
David on Twitter says, why couldn't the elliptical orbit's orientation be due to a passing dark body that is not easily observable? Is that possible?
Yeah, it is. I mean, basically, that's what this planet is an orbiting dark body.
Yeah.
Because it's not very bright and it's fairly distant.
So David's very idea is about this planet. Michael, anything you want to add there?
Well, he's exactly right. Right now, Michael Brown and Konstantin Batygin and lots of other people are looking for that dark body that happens to be passing. It could be the case that there is an object not bound to our solar system, an interloper that's just passing through the neighborhood. But it's more likely that this sort of orientation of orbits would occur if repeated perturbations by an object over a period of many millions of years as an object comes around again and again and again were happening. So I think it's a little more likely that this is an object bound to our solar system than a passing interloper.
All right. It's the Monthly Science Roundtable, and our panel from RIT is talking about this possible Planet 9 or 10 or whatever you want to call it. The bottom line is potential evidence that a planet very, very far out there in our own solar system has yet to be discovered. And Kevin Cook was saying, it's potentially the size of a planet that we don't have in the solar system, about 10 Earths in mass, if it's there. And it's a strange conversation because you say if it's there, but we don't know yet. There's evidence that something is influencing objects out there, but we don't have visual confirmation of this. So it's a very interesting kind of conversation. And we've got a lot of your questions that we've been answering. Barry, I'm going to get to your question that just came in after this short break, and then we're going to turn the conversation to some other things that Brian Koberlein's been writing about as well. So a lot to talk about here. If you want to call the program, it's a great panel to answer your questions as they've been doing. It's 844-295-TALK. It's toll-free, 844-295-8255 on the Monthly Science Roundtable. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on the next Connections First Hour, we look at Bob Wiesner's guilty plea in light of bid rigging in Monroe County. What does that mean for taxpayers and for that case going forward? We'll take a look at that. Then in our second hour, we're talking about reshaping Rochester. The annual speaker series continues with Equity by Design. How do we design a more equitable region? Talk to you Tuesday.
People in Flint, Michigan have a lot of questions for public officials, but the one on everyone's mind, when can they drink the water again?
When are you gonna fix it? And I mean fix it right.
We'll have a report from Flint, plus the latest from the campaign trail and the Iowa caucuses. That's later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on WXXI.
Welcome back to Connections. If you haven't figured it out by now, this is one of my favorite subjects, which is a great irony because when I was dating my wife in college, my goal was never to set foot in Clippinger Hall at Ohio University, where all of the chemistry and a lot of the science work was done. And she made me step foot in that hall on graduation day just to say that I did. But as I've gone throughout my life as a proud skeptic, I love these discussions. And in particular, I appreciate having really good communicators come on because I think it's vital that we be able to talk about this beyond just the science community that's discussing and researching, et cetera. And they're doing a wonderful job for us today. Brian Koberlein, Michael Richman, Kevin Cook, all here from RIT, answering some of your questions. So Kevin Cook, you get the next one from Barry. Barry just wants to know how big our solar system is, how far out it goes, because we've been using astronomical unit, which is a unit of one sun to the Earth, 30 astronomical units out to Neptune, and maybe 700 to 1,000 to this new would-be planet. But then what beyond that? How big?
So beyond that, I would say that the property line for our solar system could be a few thousand AU out, because there is something called the Oort cloud, which surrounds our solar system. It's basically this debris field of spare ice and rock and dust from when the solar system first formed, but it was really far out. It never got attached to anything. So we kind of have this garbage laying around right on the exterior of our solar system, several thousand AU out.
All right, so this, as much as we talk about Pluto being way out there in the solar system, it doesn't seem all that impressive anymore based on what we're hearing. Pluto is how many, by the way? Because Neptune's 30, Pluto is
35?
35, but goes out as far as 40 at some points. It has a relatively eccentric orbit.
Okay. But, you know, in terms of a solar system that goes to, what you say, 2,000 to 3,000?
Yeah.
Pluto's not that impressive.
No.
It hasn't gone that far out. So, and no offense to Pluto. Poor Pluto has just been taking slights all hour long. Michael Richman shaking his head again. But that's okay. And you know what? Pluto's got a sense of humor about it now because it has had its moment in the spotlight with this recent probe and flyby, which to me has been one of the most thrilling scientific observation times in my own lifetime. And Brian, Again, I didn't grow up in science, but for you, you agree with that?
Oh, yeah. It was huge just because we've always loved Pluto. And not only do we do a flyby, we got lots of interesting surprises.
All right. So before I deflect the conversation in other directions, let me just ask all three of you, based on what we learned and what might maybe, unfortunately, we may never get to know. I don't know when the next time we'll get a probe there. There's a lot of other priorities. But what was the most exciting thing that you learned, and what big question do you still want answered about Pluto, Brian?
Mountains on Pluto, and why?
A terse and perfect explanation there. Michael Richman?
Well, the probe hasn't finished sending back to Earth all the information it gathered during its brief flyby. So my question is, what's left that we don't know yet?
Kevin?
Yeah, I'm very curious in, do Pluto and its biggest moon, Charon, share some common formation mechanism? Because it looks like there's some clues towards that.
Okay. Jake followed up, by the way, and really Jake revealed what he's getting at when he asked. Jake was the one who asked, well, if science has this one wrong, is there egg on science's face? What he's just showing is some impatience here, as his next comment shows. And we've talked about it on this program. If you love science and you love exploration of our solar system and other galaxies, you're going to have to accept that some mysteries are well beyond our lifetime in solvability. And Jake just writes, the response of your panel to my probe comment was exactly what I expected to hear and horribly depressing at the same time. It means even if we find it, it will still just be a handful of pixels with no data or pixels worth of data with a couple of fun facts with a bazillion question marks when I die. That's going to be a thorn in the back of my mind for decades. Thanks very much. That's from Jake. But we all have to accept, don't we have to accept that there are mysteries that will never get solved in our lifetime?
Well, ever since I learned that the universe is around 13 billion years old and the sun will go on shining for another 5 billion years, I've been pretty depressed.
Kevin, you want to weigh in there?
Yeah, I think there's a really good Neil deGrasse Tyson quote. I can't remember the exact wording, but it's something along the lines of, to love science is to love the questions themselves. You're in it for the investigative process, not for having all the answers.
He's so high-minded. Sorry, Jake. It is true. Off-air question comes from Jim, listening in Penyan. He's listening on Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM WEOS in the Finger Lakes, where we simulcast. And Jim just wants to know, could this planet be a possible captured rogue planet from another solar system?
I don't know enough about it to give a reasonable answer, I suppose. It's an interesting...
Could that happen?
If it made a close flyby of the sun, there are ways that it maybe interacted with Jupiter enough to capture it. That would be, interesting just in and of itself because it is such a large planet if that's out there.
Interesting. Michael Richman, you're nodding, yeah? You agree with that?
It's possible. I really am not an expert in the dynamics of how planets interact with each other gravitationally, so I don't know whether a real expert would be able to say, oh, no, that's not possible, perhaps. Okay. But it sounds intriguing.
What do you think, Kevin?
I mean, it's not off the board yet. We still just don't know enough about the planet and its current orbit to determine whether or not that's a possibility.
Okay, great question, Jim. I had never even considered that. We've been talking about this Planet Nine, and if you're just joining us for our monthly science roundtable, it's a couple of researchers at Caltech who, back in 2014, discovered evidence, we're talking way beyond Pluto even, well beyond Pluto, that... Some space bodies were behaving strangely, as if some large planet were influencing them, and they believe, I think it's fair to say Mike Brown believes it. I mean, he said he'd place bets on anybody who's a non-believer. He's in on this, but he thinks there is a planet out there that we can't see yet, but with more instrumentation and more technology, eventually we will. But there's a lot scientifically that we've got to go through before we say, yep, he nailed that one. So that's what we've been talking about. But before we lose the hour, there's a couple of other interesting things that I think are worth discussing. And Brian writes about these and more on a daily basis in One Universe at a Time, but writes for a number of other publications as well. And I was reading some of what Brian had his eye on in a new paper in Astrobiology, proposing a solution about life out there beyond our own solar system, life in the universe. And Brian says, perhaps life does arise on most potentially habitable worlds, but then what happens?
Then it dies off too quickly to really make for a difference.
What's the term? The Gaian bottleneck?
The Gaian bottleneck, yeah. The basic idea is that the evidence that we have so far is that there are lots of planets out in the universe, and there are possibly lots of potentially habitable planets. We also know things about astrochemistry that the kind of building blocks of life seem to form fairly readily. We find them in comets and asteroids, for example. So one of the big questions is, if the building blocks are common and if planets are common, why don't we see evidence of life everywhere?
And by the way, when Brian says lots, as in like there's lots of possibly habitable worlds, he doesn't mean like, you know, maybe a few dozen or a few hundred. We're talking billions of possibilities out there.
50 to 100 billion in our galaxy alone.
So, okay, so elaborate then. So
the idea of this new work is that maybe life does form readily on potentially habitable planets, but because of the evolution of a solar system, planets would generally tend to drift out of the habitable zone as their geological activity continues and as the sun evolves. And so it's possible that a planet like Earth, life got a strong enough foothold to actually maintain its viability as the solar system evolves. Whereas Mars, perhaps, as a different example, might have had life early on and then, well, didn't have enough mass and was a little bit too far out for life to really latch on and stay over billions of years.
So when you're talking about life, we're talking probably singular, cellular, you know,
very simple organisms,
non-complex
early on.
Life.
Right, non-complex life.
You're not saying life commonly arises but then dies out, as in the complex form that we're used to.
Right, we're talking about possibly things like single-celled organisms, and that may be that if we could go to other solar systems, most of what we would find is this kind of fossil evidence of basic single-cell organisms.
And so that would present an interesting wrinkle in sort of the great filter question, because when we talk about the great filter, what is it that prevents life from becoming like us? You know, complex. You know, we are the peak of complexity in the whole universe, right? As I'm being cheeky. Of course, we may be totally unintelligent compared to what's out there. We don't know. But what is it that potentially could prevent life from going from singular cellular, not complex, to sort of this autonomous multicellular? And one of the ideas was, this is just entirely uncommon that something happened that is extremely unusual, or maybe even singular in our case, that we went from this, that life, as Brian's saying, is possible, that there's a lot of singular cellular life, but not like us, and something happened, but we are unique or close to unique. And the wrinkle that Brian's discussing is the speed at which this would move. See, my concern then would be, Brian, if life is out there, you want to give it time to find a way to evolve in a complex form. And the Gaian bottleneck is sort of indicating a lot of the times it doesn't have enough time to do that, yeah?
Right. I mean, if you look at our own history, single-celled organisms are the dominant organism for most of the history of life on Earth. It's only in the very late stages that you start getting complex organisms. And so single-celled life would have to survive for billions of years to develop this kind of complexity. If it can't do that, you're not going to get there.
Yeah, and just imagine, maybe somebody from planet Marklar did show up on our planet billions of years ago, and there were singular cellular life, and they went, boy, Earth seemed like such a candidate, and it just never happened. You know, you have to really catch the right time. So there's something, Jake, there's another thing to be sort of depressed about. We're just giving Jake all kinds of reasons to feel blue today on this beautiful winter day. Okay, another story that caught my eye came from Michael, which is, from in Gizmodo, scientists figured out a way to see a black hole with just a backyard telescope, Michael?
So we've known for a long time that there are some black holes in the universe around which gas spirals and spirals and spirals and eventually falls in. When gas gets really close to a black hole, it speeds up to very high speeds, close to the speed of light, heats up and emits all kinds of radiation, including X-rays. It turns out that X-rays are very good at passing through things. You probably know that because when you go to the doctor, he shoots X-rays through your hands to look at the bones. Those X-rays from down deep in this cloud of gas that surrounds the black hole, they can escape from close to the black hole, zip out into the universe, and we have X-ray telescopes that can observe them. So for the past 20 or 30 years, astronomers have used X-ray telescopes to look deep in close to the edges of a black hole where hot gas is spiraling around. It's thought that some of that hot gas also would emit optical light that we can see with our eyes or ordinary telescopes, but that that optical light can't get out through the cloud of gas that surrounds the black hole, that it sort of gets blocked. Well, This past summer, in June, there was a system in our own Milky Way galaxy that consists of an ordinary star like our sun and a black hole orbiting around each other. And this system suddenly got much brighter than usual. What it probably means is that a whole bunch of gas from that companion star started to fall onto the black hole. And an alert went out around the world to people with small observatories and large observatories. And so I started looking at it with our telescope here in Rochester on the RIT campus. And people in Japan and in Europe and in Western US, they also looked at it with small telescopes. And it turned out that the optical light that we saw from this source, it stayed bright for only a couple of days. But during those days, the optical light sort of flickered brighter and fainter and brighter and fainter on timescales of a few minutes. When we looked and compared that record of flickering to the X-rays that were observed by an orbiting satellite at the same time, we saw that when the X-rays flickered up and down, the optical light also flickered up and down. And this was completely unexpected because we thought, well, the optical light we see is coming from cooler gas farther away, and it shouldn't be following this sort of flickering pattern. So it was a bit of a surprise that we might, in fact, under some circumstances, if we're lucky, be able to see all the way down in close to a black hole's edges with ordinary optical telescopes. That means that maybe in the future, if we see similar outbursts, we might be able to learn more about black holes with our ordinary ground-based telescopes instead of having to rely upon only the expensive orbiting X-ray telescopes.
That's great stuff. And just another example of all the wonderful things happening here. RIT loaning us three of the great minds for our monthly science roundtable. And Kevin Cook's just a PhD student, merely a PhD student, in a wonderful addition to this panel, by the way. I hope you'll come back.
Thank you very much. And I'd love to come back.
Well, you know, it's just great fun to talk about these subjects. So, when Kevin is even more published and out there in the world, we'll have even more reasons to bring him back. But Kevin's a PhD student in the Astrophysical Sciences and Tech program at RIT. Michael Richman, RIT Professor of Physics and the Director of the RIT Observatory. Thank you, Michael.
You're welcome.
Great having you. And Pluto thanks you as well. Brian Koberlein, RIT Senior Lecturer of Physics, One Universe at a Time. Nice to see you back here, Brian. Thank you
very much for having me.
And the great fun for me. Hope you enjoyed it as well in the audience there. And thanks to Valerie LaBanca, the engineer of this broadcast. Marielle Brinkerhoff is our intern this semester, along with Kate Cowie Haskell and Megan Mack, the producer of Connections. Our thanks to Barsook Records for the music, and I'm Evan Dawson. And thanks for listening to member-supported public radio.